everyone. We are about ready to start. My name is Eric Jaffe. I'm the chairman of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group at the Federalist Society, and we're pleased to welcome you here for the next in our lecture series on election law, our election law lecture series. Today we have a paper presented by Professor David Primo and written with his colleague, Professor Jeffrey Milo, my apologies to him, wherever he is. Professor Primo is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester. He has his PhD in political science and an MA in economics from Stanford, and writes and does research quite a bit now on things like public financing and campaign finance reform. Amongst many, many other qualifications, I'll try to keep this short, he served as an expert witness in the McConnell versus FEC case and has frequently addressed these topics in the media and in other contexts. Commenting on his paper will be Dr. Michael McDonald, Professor Michael McDonald, who's a professor of government and politics at George Mason University and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He got his PhD in political science as well from the University of California, San Diego, and a BS in economics from Caltech. Professor McDonald has worked for a variety of organizations dealing with election-related matters, including the National Exit Poll Organization. He's consulted for the U.S. Election Assistance Commission and regularly works as a redistricting consultant in various states and, I presume, in litigation. That's really all you guys need to know about them. They are well-qualified, well-learned, and will tell us a lot about the data concerning public financing of elections. I'm sure most of you in this audience are familiar with the topic, but for those who may be less familiar, many states and a lot of reform groups have been either adopting or calling for partial or complete public financing of elections as a means of avoiding the unseemliness and various other supposed bad effects of having candidates go out and beg for money. Rather than have them beg for money for private citizens, they would instead have them beg for money from the state, and the state would then presumably get to control what they said and what they did and what they thought, and that would be a wonderful, beautiful world. As you can see, I'm not unbiased. Each side, both pro and con, set a variety of empirical claims regarding the effects, positive and negative, of campaign finance reform in the form of public financing. Those claims are often touted as if they were the God's honest truth, but I think today we will have some debate about whether any of those claims or some of those claims or all of those claims are in fact supported by what data we do have or not supported given what data we lack. And with that, I will leave the debate up to Professor Primo and Professor McDonald to both present and potentially refute the various points on this topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that introduction, Eric. First, I wanted to start off by thanking the Federalist Society for inviting Jeff and I to write this paper and to present it here to you today. This is actually a particularly apt time to be discussing the public financing of elections. We are just a couple months out after the Randall versus Sorrell decision the Supreme Court handed down earlier this year, in which they ruled that, once again, mandatory expenditure limits on how much candidates can spend during campaigns are unconstitutional. They were ruled unconstitutional in 1976, and lo and behold, they're still unconstitutional in 2006. So there's some stability there over 30 years. The court also ruled for the first time that contribution limits could actually be set too low, that there was such a thing as a contribution limit that simply is so low that the damage to First Amendment concerns, or the damage to the First Amendment, outweighs any concern about the appearance of corruption. So this decision has galvanized the reform community. It's galvanized the reform community around this idea of public financing of elections and clean elections. And I'll talk in a moment about the distinction between just general public financing and clean elections. The motivation is that if you can't mandate that spending be set at a certain threshold in elections, why not give candidates an incentive to spend less by giving them some money from taxpayer coffers? And throughout this discussion, I'm going to be using the term public financing. And really what we're talking about is taxpayer financing. This is coming out of government funds. Now, reform groups will say, no, it's not. It's voluntary. It's through a tax checkoff and so on. But the fact is that a simple economics argument will suggest that no matter how you define it, ultimately it's money that's not going into government funds. It's coming out of taxpayers' pockets. And so That won't shape much of my discussion today, but in terms of the normative debates, really that shouldn't even be an issue. It is taxpayer finance, and the discussion can be should it be or shouldn't it be, but whether it is or not really shouldn't be a question at this point. And what I wanted to talk about today was this empirical side of what we know about public financing and what we don't know about public financing. Public financing is held out as the great hope for American democracy. And it sounds good on paper, right? Take the money out of politics and we'll have a better democracy, we'll have better campaigns. So let me talk briefly first about what public financing is, then talk about some of the claims that are made on the pro and con side and what we actually know. And then I'm going to try to tie this all together in terms of why, as reformers or as individuals against reform, why the data matters, why social science matters for our understanding of campaign finance. So as I mentioned earlier, this is primarily a post-Buckley phenomenon. This idea of giving candidates money to run for office comes out of the fact that mandatory expenditure limits were ruled unconstitutional in 1976. So one way to limit spending in campaigns is to give candidates, again, an incentive to keep spending down. The way to do that is to say, we'll give you this pot of money. In return, you can't spend over X, and you can't raise contributions greater than Y from any given individual or PAC, let's say. It's used, of course, in the presidential race and in several states and localities. And the reform that's really gaining a lot of steam now is known as clean elections. And clean elections is just another way of saying that government is the sole funding source for a candidate who accepts public funding. The little asterisk there, often to qualify for this public funding under clean elections, you need to raise small contributions, $5, $10, from a few thousand people to show that you're a serious candidate, and then you get the remainder of the money from government. In return, you raise no other money. So this is really the extreme version of public financing. It takes all, if everybody were to accept it, takes all, for the most part, of the private money out of a campaign. So this should be nirvana in the campaign finance community. It eliminates the unseemly money chase. And, of course, it's got to be a boon for democracy. Okay. So first quote, this is from the press. Okay, this is not a reformer speaking, from the National Journal. The simple fact, and now that word is very important, the simple fact is that public financing would make it easier for challengers to unseat incumbents by leveling the political money playing field. Okay, so if we implement public financing, we're going to see more competitive elections. We know it's true because the National Journal said it's a fact. Okay? Now, that's a news organization speaking. What about reformers? So in the San Jose Mercury News, two advocates for clean elections said, quote, until we change how election campaigns are funded, we're going to have a stream of stories that make for great reading but which drive voters from the poll and perpetuate bottomless cynicism about feckless politicians. And that was clearly a phrase they spent a lot of time sort of tweaking to get just right. Okay? But there are two serious empirical claims in there. One, we're going to get higher turnout. Two, we're actually going to see people have more faith in government. Okay? They're going to trust government more. And as a consequence, democracy will be improved. Third quotation, I'm not going to put it up here, I'm just going to read it. This actually came to my attention in a nice piece that Allison Hayward wrote for the Goldwater Institute. This is the statement appeared in the Clean Elections Act that was recently passed in Arizona. Arizona and Maine are the two states that passed clean elections via citizen initiative. Connecticut just passed it this year through the legislative process. And they wrote in the Arizona law, the people of Arizona declare our intent to create a clean election system that will improve the integrity of Arizona state government by diminishing the influence of special interest money, will encourage citizen participation in the political process, and will promote freedom of speech under the U.S. and Arizona constitutions. Campaigns will become more issue-oriented and less negative because there will be no need to challenge the sources of campaign money. Very noble. But again, making empirical claims, claims that are either true or false. Okay? They can be observed, they can be examined. But the problem is, in the debate over campaign finance, that we take these claims, empirical claims, and rather than test them, at least as part of the debate, we assert them to be fact. And I think that's a problem. And in fact, there's another part of the story. Okay? And that's that when you actually look at the scientific studies on campaign finance, there's very little evidence that public financing actually has any of these positive effects on American democracy. And so one of the things Jeff and I would like to call for is greater attention to scientific inquiry to inform policy debates. We're not naive. We're political scientists and economists. We don't think that the rough and tumble of politics is somehow going to be assumed away or is going to go away. There are always going to be the rough and tumble of politics will always be there, but we think that organizations like the National Journal shouldn't write things like, as I'll show you in a moment why, shouldn't write things like "the fact is" when it's not a fact, and that reformers shouldn't make claims like "people will trust government more" when they don't know that to be the case. And I'm also gonna take a few digs at the anti-reform community here, because there's some of that on the other side as well, so I'm going to be fair and balanced. But that's ultimately what I'm going to talk about today. Okay, so what are the claims that are made by the pro-reform side? Well, we're going to see less influence peddling. The argument here is straightforward. Candidates aren't spending their time raising money. They're not beholden to interest groups anymore. They're not going to change their votes on the floor of the legislature because of the contribution they receive from a particular PAC or a particular individual. Okay. Secondly, we're going to see improved perceptions of government. Citizens won't be subjected anymore to the unseemly money chase, the fact that elected officials are bought and sold to the highest bidder. All of that will go away, and therefore people are going to have more faith in government. We're going to see more competitive elections, and there's a two-part argument here. First is a selection issue. Candidates who might not otherwise enter the race because they don't want to go either through the trouble of raising money or they don't think they can be competitive with an incumbent financially will now decide to enter a race because they're likely to be competitive. Assuming the incumbent were to take the public funding as well, they'd have about the same amount of money. The challenger would no longer be at a financial disadvantage. The second part of that argument is that once a candidate decides to actually run for office, the fact that they have this public money allows them to do better in the race. They have more money than they would have otherwise. They're able to be more competitive. This is going to lead overall to more competitive elections. Next, we'll see higher turnout. And that's presumably a function of the second and third points I made there. People trust the government more. They feel more efficacious. They're more likely to vote. People observe a competitive congressional race or competitive legislative race at the state level. They're more likely to vote. All of these things should be in the direction of seeing more turnout rather than less. And finally, greater efficiency. So what do I mean by this? Economist at University of Chicago, Stephen Levitt, the author of Freakonomics, some of you may have read that book, recently did a study, maybe about 5-6 years ago, on the impact of campaign spending on election outcomes. And he essentially found that at the margin, you know, once you raise a sufficient amount of money, additional spending really has no impact on election outcomes. So he said that basically we're citizens who are donating, interest groups that are donating, candidates that are accepting all this money, everybody's wasting their time and their money. And so his argument is it would be much more efficient to have, ideally, in his mind, mandatory expenditure limits set about $200,000 or $300,000 less than the average race currently costs, or, barring that for constitutional reasons, public funding that would, again, lower spending by about $200,000 or $300,000 per race. His argument is you wouldn't change the outcome of many races at all, and you'd get the benefit of saving all of this money and using it for more productive purposes. Okay. So these are five claims made by the pro-reform side. So what does the anti-reform side have to say? Well, they say you'll actually observe less competition as a result of public financing. The argument here is that public financing laws are typically going to benefit incumbents. Either the limits will be set so low that even if both candidates accept public financing, the greater name recognition and other resources that an incumbent has will allow the incumbent to emerge victorious. Or the laws will simply be written intentionally to discourage challengers from entering the race. So the argument there is that we're going to observe less competition as a result of public financing. The second point is partisan maneuvering. That campaign finance laws designed as part of the political process are going to have partisan components to them. We're seeing this certainly at the federal level right now. Democrats used to be very much pro-campaign finance reform. And now, you know, they're careful. They want to protect the 527s. Republicans all of a sudden have discovered that campaign finance laws can be a problem. They want to see more regulation of the 527s. Okay, so there is some partisan component to all of this. Okay? People are concerned about some of the anti-reform side is concerned about the fact that parties are going to try to use these laws to gain advantage. And finally, there's the issue of inflexibility. This is a point that's been made by Brad Smith, among others, that these laws simply can't be designed to deal with all of the changes that occur in the way campaigns are run over time. That people are going to end up needing more money, less money, and it's very hard to calculate and design these laws to be flexible and to be responsive to how campaigns change over time. Okay, so these are three of the main arguments made by the anti-reform community. Okay. Now, fortunately, all of these are, in principle, testable. So I wanted to talk about exactly what we do know from the existing scientific body of work on this subject and what we don't know. Okay. So what we do know is that the reason you're unlikely to see less influence peddling if you implemented clean elections is that there isn't a lot of influence peddling right now via campaign finance or via campaign contributions. There are scores of studies at the federal level that show that the impact of campaign contributions on how legislators vote is basically non-existent. So there's essentially no evidence, systematic scientific evidence, to support the claim that money buys policy outcomes. Now, we don't have similar studies at the state level, so it could be that the states are somehow different, but our best evidence right now, existing evidence, suggests that there just is no effect. Money may play a role in securing access. That's subject to debate right now. There are studies on both sides. But in terms of actually changing how a legislator votes, there simply isn't evidence to support that claim. What about perceptions of government? Well, it turns out there's little substantive impact there as well. Jeff and I did the first large-scale study of this question and actually found that states with public financing laws had citizens who trusted their government and had efficacy toward government that was slightly lower than states without such laws. And that's a statistically significant finding. Now, I don't want to make too much of that in that the result was substantively modest. This wasn't a huge effect. But given the claims that this is going to have a huge positive impact on how citizens view their government, the fact that public financing actually has a small but real negative effect, I think is worth noting. What about the question of more or less competitive elections? Well, again, no systematic evidence supporting either view here. Okay? So at best we can tell, public financing has on net no effect on elections. And Jeff and I and Tim Grossclose, a political scientist at UCLA, just finished a study looking at gubernatorial elections over the last 25 years, showing that there was simply at the margin no impact of public financing on whether a gubernatorial election was competitive or not. And that is actually forthcoming in a book that's edited by these two gentlemen, John Samples and Michael McDonald. Fourth, what about partisan advantage? Well, again, in that same study, we show that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans benefit from public financing. On net, the average margin in a gubernatorial race is unaffected by whether or not a state has public financing. Now, this is not something I really talk about in the paper, but something we could discuss during the Q&A. You know, maybe it's not the case that Democrats or Republicans benefit, but that they both benefit at the expense of third parties. Third parties typically get the short end of the stick in public financing laws. They face a much higher threshold to qualify for public financing than any of the major party candidates do typically. And lastly, higher turnout. Again, no evidence that turnout increases in states with public financing versus states without public financing. So, and actually one more claim I wanted to talk about, the issue of greater efficiency. Well, Levitt's argument actually suffers from two flaws. The first flaw to Levitt's argument that let's just lower spending on all campaigns won't make a difference in the outcomes is that it doesn't, and he acknowledges this in his paper, it doesn't account for the fact that candidates aren't going to stand still in response to the law. They're going to adjust to the law. They're going to be strategic. Same way, if marginal tax rates increase from 25% tomorrow to 75%, people's behavior in terms of how much work they did would be affected. Same principle. That's not accounted for in Levitt's analysis. Second issue is that even in Levitt's analysis, there were a few races that would have changed. Now, in a situation we find ourselves in at the congressional level where very few incumbents are defeated by challengers in any given year, even the change of one or two races can make a difference. Okay? Thirdly, Levitt treats spending purely instrumentally. He's interested just in whether spending impacts the outcome of an election. But there are lots of studies that suggest that there's actually a benefit to campaign spending, that we actually want to see more spending, not less, because spending has positive effects on how much information citizens have, has positive effects on citizens voting, even has positive effects on how citizens view their government. Okay? So all of these factors suggest that even if that additional $200,000 of spending doesn't change the outcome of the race, okay, we still might want to see that spending take place because it's providing some valuable information to citizens and therefore is a net positive for democracy. So, in a nutshell then, what we know about public financing is that there aren't any huge and lasting benefits of this reform. What don't we know? Well, we don't know whether legislatures look systematically different after public financing than before public financing. And this is important because presumably this could change public policy. If you have different sorts of individuals, whether in their policy positions or if you have a more diverse legislature, this presumably could change policy outcomes. But we don't know the answer to that question. We don't have very many good studies on that question. Another question we'd like to be able to answer, but that's very difficult to answer right now, is how variation in public funding laws impacts both election and policy outcomes. Does setting a spending limit of $500,000 versus $700,000 in a gubernatorial race, how does that change election outcomes? What about the threshold for qualifying for funding? We don't know the answers to a lot of these questions, in part because we just don't have enough data. And it's very hard to compare across states. It's hard to know what a $500,000 limit in Arizona would be versus a $500,000 limit in California, let's say. We know that in California that would be a very small amount of money. We don't know how much smaller in terms of the cost of running for office. And this is an important point because I think this is often overlooked in debates we see over things like clean elections. The jury's still out on clean elections. We just don't know what the long-term effects of clean elections are going to be. The studies I referred to earlier on public financing looked at all sorts of public financing laws, not just clean elections. So Arizona and Maine have only enacted clean elections in the last 3 or 4 election cycles. Connecticut doesn't start for another couple of years. That hasn't stopped both sides of the debate from arguing that either clean elections is a rousing success or clean elections is a colossal failure. So as an example, a reform group in Arizona said, look at the Arizona Senate. This is evidence that clean elections is exactly what we said it would be. They said competition increased dramatically from 1998 to 2002. Their evidence was that there were more races that actually had opponents in them versus 1998, where there were no opponents. So in 2002, more races with opponents than in 1998. That's a pretty weak definition of competitiveness. That's a pretty low threshold to set for yourself, that you're actually getting somebody to run for office, whether they get 5% of the vote or 10% of the vote. So I looked at this data, and Jeff and I looked at this data, and we said, let's adopt a slightly stricter definition of competitiveness. How many races actually were closer than 60-40? Okay, so there's less than a 20 points separating the candidates. Now, a lot of people would think 60-40 is a blowout, so we're being conservative here. Let's call that a competitive race, anything tighter than 60-40. In 1998, 4 races where candidates were tighter than 60-40. In 2002, 4 races in which candidates were tighter than 60-40. No change. If you look at just the average winning margin in Arizona Senate races during those two time periods, the average winning margin actually goes up from 1998 to 2002. It's a small increase, but it is an increase. Now, I'm not making a causal claim there. I'm not arguing that public financing caused this for 3 reasons. First, it's just 1 year of data, so 1 change. Secondly, this is also the same time that term limits were enacted, and it's the same time that redistricting occurred. So there's so many things going on between 1998 and 2002, it'd be very hard to attribute the lack of a change just to public financing. Okay? But the fact is that the claim that public financing has been a rousing success in Arizona has got to be at this point just one of interpretation, because the facts, I would argue, don't really support that. And this is true, you know, on the other side of the debate. People have made the claim, well, clean elections is clearly a failure, presumably citing evidence like what I just cited, saying, look, it hasn't had much of an impact. But really, in some sense, that's slightly unfair, because it's just, I would argue, too early to tell. We need some more years of data to really see what the long-term implications of this will be. I think we have good reason to be skeptical that clean elections will ever be successful, and I'll talk about why that is in a moment. But the jury, I would argue, is still out on clean elections overall. So what do all these results mean for the debate over public financing? Well, Jeff and I think that one of the things that's missing in the debate over campaign finance is cost-benefit analysis. Okay? Presumably, in regulation, cost-benefit analysis is used by the EPA, it's used by the FAA, used by all regulatory agencies, except for the issue of campaign finance. Nobody thinks about, when promoting a campaign finance reform, what the actual costs of this are going to be. Okay? And it imposes real costs, make no mistake about it. Okay, putting aside the administrative costs and legal fees, you have the fact that this is actually money coming out of taxpayer, out of the general fund. Even if it's not directly coming out of the general fund, it's money that's diverted before it gets into the general fund. So that's the equivalent of either a tax increase, because the money's got to come from somewhere, or a reduction in government services, both of which negatively impact taxpayers. And as it stands right now, there are uncertain rewards. And we haven't been able to find any evidence that public financing has large positive effects on how democracy functions. So from a cost-benefit perspective, it seems that caution should be the watchword when people are considering reform, rather than this is going to be the greatest thing that ever happened to American democracy, every state should enact it tomorrow. And we really think there needs to be more caution in this. That said, I think over time, it's going to be the case that any sort of public financing will not have significant effects, will not pass the cost-benefit test. I can't assert that that's the case right now because, again, we still have the jury still out on clean elections and other more recent reforms. But there are two problems in the design of any sort of law regulating the behavior of Congress or regulating the behavior of individuals in government. And I talk about the political problem and the design problem a little bit in a book I'm finishing up on budget rules. Okay? And what are these two problems, and you know, how does budgeting connect to campaign finance, connect to ethics? Well, the political problem, and I think a point that's often overlooked in this debate, is that these laws are not made by people who have the public interest at heart, who care about the will of the people. And they're not made behind closed doors by people running models to see what the best law they can design is. They're made by politicians who have interests. Okay? I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's, you know, democracy is the best system we've got. But it is made by people who have interests, who aren't necessarily concerned with what is, quote, right or what's optimal for society. So it's not surprising that we're going to see laws that are written that are going to be ineffectual. Now, a response to that might be, well, we'll just bypass the legislature. We'll just go to the citizen initiative. The problem with the citizen initiative is, of course, that legislatures can respond to that. Legislatures can try to undo what the citizenry has done as part of an initiative. And in fact, in Arizona this year, they've attempted to do that. Now, even if you could solve the political problem, which you can't, but suppose you could, there's still the design problem. And this goes back to Hayek and his idea of the use of knowledge in society, that there's no way for somebody to sit down and write a campaign finance law that's going to be able to account for all of the ways in which candidates and lawyers will attempt to circumvent the law. Okay? So laws are designed to be circumvented, okay, when it comes to campaign finance, when it comes to budgeting, any sort of process reforms. So it shouldn't be surprising, okay, that all laws have unintended consequences. In fact, I would argue that the most important consequences of most campaign finance laws are the unintended ones. Okay? The laws rarely do what they're set out to do. Rather, they create all sorts of issues that we never knew existed, or, thinking more cynically, that people knew existed but just ignored until after the law was passed. We're seeing this now with the debate over 527s and 501c3s, and these debates go on in Washington, okay, over these sort of nitty-gritty aspects of the tax code. Okay, but and all of it, underlying all of it, really is that that those who write the laws can never keep up with people's ability to try to circumvent the law. Okay. Now, on the one hand, this creates a constant need for more reform, so to some that might not be a bad thing, but from a social scientific perspective, I would argue that you're never going to get a law that's going to pass the cost-benefit analysis test in the long run. Okay. So, just to wrap up, Reddy mentioned this at the outset, that Randall is was the galvanizing force for the reform community to push public financing. Clean elections is now priority number one for the reform groups. Secondly, there really is no systematic empirical evidence, okay, that public financing has any positive effects on election outcomes, on how citizens view government, or on policy outcomes. Unfortunately, unsubstantiated claims abound. We see this, again, on both sides of the debate. But for the most part, my concern is with claims that are perpetuated by the press. That's why I put up that National Journal quotation at the beginning of my talk. The fact is that the press has a responsibility, it's apropos that we're at the National Press Club, has a responsibility to not make claims like the fact is, when not only is it not a fact, but the opposite could potentially be true. Okay? They need to be much more careful attention paid to scientific analysis, but unfortunately, it's much easier to simply take sound bites from those against and for reform, arguing about all of the positives and benefits, positives and all the benefits we're going to see from reform, or all of the costs we're going to see from reform. And it might be the case, Jeff and I have made this point in the paper on trust in government, that one reason you might observe the surprising negative effect of public financing is that the public has made all these promises for how reform is going to improve the way democracy functions. Then when public financing doesn't deliver, that might be, in fact, what's causing some disenchantment with government. And with that, I'll turn it over to Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, David, and Jeff in absentia, and thank you to the Federalist Society. So I told David when we were preparing for this that I would have a slide that would kill everything that he had to say, and I just needed one slide to do it. And so, David, hopefully you can see the slide. There's the slide. So if we never needed, if we always needed to know exactly what a policy outcome was or a technological innovation was going to do before we implemented it, then this is where we would be. We would never have invented fire, and we'd still be running around as cavemen. And so I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that just because we're not sure if something doesn't work, whether or not we should move forward with that innovation and see if it does work. And so none of this would actually be possible. None of this, the research that David has done, would be possible if there hadn't been the policy innovation in the first place. So we would have to see states adopt these public financing laws and observe the effects that those laws have in order for any sort of research to be done, really, in a larger context of the studies that David and Jeff envision. But that doesn't mean that we can't use some, you know, science to try and divine what's going to happen by looking at other ways in which campaign financing interacts with elections and government policymaking. And hopefully our caveman can, you know, finally sit down, put down his spear and sit down and use the computer. By the way, I am absolutely shocked to hear that the media simplify arguments. I can't believe it myself. This is just the world that we live in, and I have seen these comments. I do redistricting reform is my main interest in elections, and I have seen the grandiose statements made both ways within that realm of a debate as well. So to say the National Journal, anybody else has simplified the issues, I think it just comes with the territory, and it's something that you have to accept. Yet again, doesn't mean that we can't sit down and try and figure out how these things work so that we can inform the public debate, but trying to push through and actually change the way in which editorial boards and newspapers, reporters behave, I think is asking a little bit too much as well. But I do think that David and Jeff have some important contributions here. They lay out a nice research agenda. And so I'm going to hopefully critique that agenda a bit and make some suggestions, which I hope that they will think about in moving that agenda forward. So, to start with, you know, We're at the Federalist Society, so maybe a starting point for David's and Jeff's work is what did the Founding Fathers think about public financing? And there's a very nice book called The Right to Vote by Alexander Kazar, and he goes through the very initial debates about who was going to be eligible to vote. And this isn't directly campaign finance related, but I think that it does bear quite a bit on this. And one of the things that they said they looked at in debating on whether or not people with property would be the only people who'd be allowed to vote, one of the arguments that was made in favor of this position was to say that those with property would be able to corrupt those without property. And there were many other arguments made as well, but this clearly falls within this debate, because if public financing had, or campaign finance or money, had no effect on anybody's vote, if people were wise enough to make the choices without being influenced by the corrupting influence of money, then there would be no need for any sort of campaign finance laws. People could spend whatever they want, but people would be, the voters would be informed enough to make the informed decisions. And the solution was to restrict the franchise to those that were incorruptible, those with property. I always liked Jefferson being a good Democrat, proto-Democrat. His solution was give everybody property so that everybody would be incorruptible. But clearly that's not where we are. So let's take a look at this agenda that's laid out, and I've committed one of the biggest sins of PowerPoint presentations of putting too much information on the screen, so I apologize. The idea, I think, here is let's find some things that we can measure about the system, about the electoral system, and how public financing affects that, and what sort of outcomes we can observe as a consequence of that sort of interaction there, public financing interjected into the electoral system. And so the very first thing, and I haven't heard David or really anybody else who's looked at this has done any sort of research on it, is just, I mean, the whole notion is just equal financing. And Does it actually have the intended effect? Because not all candidates have to opt into public financing. There are candidates who can self-finance. There are candidates who can opt to just raise their own money external to the public financing. And so just a very simple, basic question I'd like to have answered is, does it actually level the playing field? And you would assume that it does, but I don't know if that's true or not. The next area, then, that David raises is about electoral competition. And I have some questions here as well, and some of this can be guided by the existing literature. How much money is needed to make a campaign viable? Maybe what we're talking about are setting floors here on viability. Let some people opt in, some people who would not be able to raise the money, who don't have the resources that incumbents do to connections to PACs and everything else in order to raise that money. Let's finance those up to a threshold that makes them competitive with the incumbents who have all these other resources. So how much money do you actually need to be competitive? I would like to see some more research done there. Another thing that I think it matters quite a bit here, too, is are all elections the same? And by this mean, I'm really thinking about the different levels of elections that are out there. One of the studies that Jeff and David have engaged in is on gubernatorial elections. Well, gubernatorial elections are actually the most competitive elections that are out there right now. You look at across the states, you find Democrats winning in Montana. You find Republicans winning in Massachusetts. And the reason is that these races are pretty much non-ideological. They're more based on filling up potholes and making the system work rather than they are about big policy issues that divide the country among red and blue lines. And so these elections themselves already, if you look across all the elections that are out there, they draw high-quality candidates. They are very competitive. I would not have expected to find public financing to have a large effect on gubernatorial elections because they're already very competitive. Where they might make a difference, and I think where the study needs to be perhaps focused, is in state legislative races, where you do see more disparity between in terms of fundraising and other resources, name recognition that candidates would have for those offices. So I'd like to see more analysis paid to these various offices to see if there are disparate effects. And this also suggests, by the way, that public financing, if you're going to enact it, you should tailor the policy or the limit or the amount of money, I should say, that you would raise to the type of office. And so I would not say that you have a one-size-fits-all. I would not say as you look across states, where you look at California's senatorial districts, they're larger than the congressional districts in California. Contrast that with the hundreds of state legislative districts in New Hampshire, which are very small size in terms of population. So these laws need to be tailored, I think, very narrowly to the state or the jurisdiction that you're looking at. Candidate quality candidate quality. And so David alluded to this. There's a mechanism for candidates to qualify for public financing. They have to raise a certain number of, say, $5 contributions from whatever number of people they can before they actually qualify for the money. And much like what I was just mentioning about the way in which to implement this, we need to actually get this law enacted properly, if that's your goal. I think you need to look at this seriously. How do you vary this? What's the right level of the amount of funding that you need, self-funding that you need to do before a candidate actually qualifies for the matching money from the state? And a normative argument that I didn't hear David make, but I think it's important against this, is that this forces money, funding, raising money, forces candidates to interact with their constituents. It forces them to have connections into communities that are interested in politics in their state or within their district. And so it has a positive effect in building that constituency to representative link. And so while this $5 contribution from 1,000 people might force you to go out and meet 1,000 people, are you meeting all of the people that need to be met within the district? Are you going to limit your interaction to just a segment of the population? And, you know, you could make the same argument against the current campaign finance laws, but it has an effect in this way because it's going to change the dynamic and way in which representatives interact with their constituency. The next point that David brought up was, or not really going in any order, better legislation and you know, quote-unquote representation here. One of the things that goes along with this that I was just mentioning is there's a claim that's been made that if you are self-financed, or then you've got to go out and raise all this money from being self-financed, meaning that you're raising your own money for your campaign. You've got to go out and you spend a lot of time on the phone fundraising. Anybody who's been involved in a campaign knows exactly what happens within the campaign, where you have to sit the candidate down for maybe 3 to 4 hours a day on the phone, talking, dialing for dollars with donors. And so there is... Okay. Yeah. Nope. Yes, personal security. Yeah.
So much for the caveman. Right.
Yeah, so much for the caveman. Where's your... hit the your deny. All right. In any case, how much the opportunity cost of dialing for dollars versus sitting down and actually learning the details of legislation. I don't know if that's measurable. I think perhaps it is. You could do some surveys of legislators and find out what the difference is in terms of public financing versus other sorts of systems. And intuitively, it strikes me that there is a relationship here, and so there may be actually some substance to this. And then there's corruption, and fortunately, for the most highly visible cases of corruption, they're rare events. And so to say that it's there's any sort of relationship between public financing and corruption, you wouldn't expect to find that relationship just because the corruption that people might observe in the press and other places would be a rare event. So you wouldn't expect there to be a correlation. I would enjoy seeing the survey where you go around asking representatives how corrupt they are so you could measure the level of corruption. I'm sure they're all going to answer honestly to that question, especially the corrupt ones. So I doubt that we're ever really going to get a handle on this issue about corruption in financing. And then one other thing that that David mentioned as I was listening to him, he mentioned how public trust, which is also related to the corruption, is lower in states that have adopted public financing. Well, here you have the chicken and egg problem where you would have perhaps higher levels of distrust of government. You might have citizens within those states be more likely to adopt this sort of public financing. And so I'd like to see some sort of longitudinal study here to really get at this, to see, you know, once you adopt public financing, what's the effect afterwards? And probably going to need to look at this over a larger number of elections or larger number of years than what we have right now, because as of right now, this is a relatively new policy innovation, so we really don't know, to echo what David was saying, we really don't know what the effects are because we haven't had enough elections to know in terms of what social scientists like to say statistically significant effects. We don't really know that yet. We have to observe more data and for us to really know what the effects are. I'm going to suggest that campaign financing, regardless of what its intended effect to be on election outcomes is supposed to be, we're never really going to be able to parse it out because the election system is a very chaotic system. And it's a diagram that I've come up with here to try and put in a very gross way all of the working parts of the election process into one diagram. And you can see that campaign finance laws only affected the election outcomes indirectly through two ways, through the types of candidates that run for office and through the money that they raise. And there are other things that are affecting these two nodes within the election process. And there are other things like the partisanship of the district that also affect election outcomes. So, and there are other reforms that are going on, and this is particularly true with Arizona, which makes it so difficult, is that they've had redistricting reform, they've had term limits, they had campaign finance limits all at the same time. And so maybe the citizens really there are unhappy about the system and they want to do something about it, or maybe there's this guy John McCain running around advocating for all these things. But in any case, it's going to be very difficult to parse these things out because you have so many reforms hitting at the same time. But if you're going to have successful reforms, I think you need to think carefully about how they're going to work. And up to this point, we've seen these public financing laws adopted through the initiative process. And it made me start thinking about, well, what are the relative benefits of doing this through the election, through a constitutional amendment, through an initiative, versus doing this through state statute? And it occurred to me that, and even as David has been talking, that because we really don't know too much about public financing, we really don't know what the proper way to implement this policy innovation would be. And if you put it into a state constitution through an initiative process, it's going to be very difficult to undo that. You're going to be stuck with a system that may or may not work. In fact, in terms of redistricting reform in Arizona, that's what the reformers are actually finding out, unhappily to their what they intended. The redistricting commission in Arizona didn't produce the intended outcome of more competitive elections. And so and it's going to be very difficult for them to undo that now, because now they're going to have to go back, if they wanted to have another initiative, and so on and so on. So this is where the academics can come in, and please fund us, to come in and study this and make hard policy recommendations on what's going to be the best sort of approach to this reform. But if you're going to do it, as Arizona and Maine and now Connecticut, then maybe what you want to do is write some broad laws into the Constitution and let the details be set through some other mechanism, maybe through state statute, maybe through an independent commission that looks at financing or something, so that you have that flexibility, so that you can adapt the way in which the law is being implemented. The problem with this, though, of course, is that the fear is that legislators, incumbents, would set the law, the limits, the way in which the policy is being implemented in such a way as to favor them over their challengers. And, you know, this isn't anything new. I mean, our founding fathers were worried about this. Madison writes about this. John Stuart Mill writes about this, how you're going to find incumbents want enact policies that are going to entrench themselves. So it's nothing new. I think we should expect it in self-interested behavior. But that's the problem with this. So there's a tension here between the two. But coming back, if you are going to need a very complicated sort of initiative adopted, it turns out that it's very difficult to pass these things in the states, because the voters are very reluctant to pass complicated reforms. And we're talking about if we really wanted to do something that would, you know, some sort of ideal world of an electoral system that you could sit down and academics could sit down and design this sort of thing, then it would be very complicated, and it would have lots of moving parts. And so voters are much more likely to reject that, as we've seen in California and Ohio. And so finally, if you're really interested in all this, buy the book that John Samples and I edited for the conference that David and others participated in. Thank you.
Great, thank you both. Usually I take the moderator's privilege, but today I think I'll pass. Maybe I'll interject later, and I'll just get straight to the audience Q&A so that a bunch of you folks can have a chance to raise your questions. Yes, sir.
Of those countries?
You know, I don't know quite as much about cross-national differences in campaign finance laws. What I do know is that there aren't a lot of cross-national studies or even studies in other countries that really look at the impact of these laws, because for the same reason that it's very hard to use federal laws here in the U.S. to look at the impact of campaign finance laws on outcomes, because there just are so few changes that it's hard to assess the actual impact of the laws. So, you know, and also those others, like for instance in Great Britain, you know, they also have a restricted campaign season. So there are all sorts of other additional laws that are on top of the campaign finance law. So the answer, to the best of my knowledge, we don't know that much about how campaign finance laws impact outcomes cross-nationally. But I don't know, Michael?
I think that's pretty fair. It's difficult to do. And so I know of some studies, I don't know any in terms of the public financing. I know of some in some other realms of studies that look cross-nationally to look at institutional effects on policy outcomes. I think it would be useful, though. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at it. Let's see a country where they've made a change, particularly in limits, and see what the sorts of effects that those have had. I think that's probably going to be more informative than, because then we'd be controlling for everything else that's particular about that country than trying to do these sort of cross-national studies, because then we run into all sorts of cultural and other political variables that are difficult to control for.
Jim?
I thought Professor McDonald's point on the moving parts was a very profound one, and I've been very skeptical of the true efficacy of studies in this area because of the difficulty that he identified. That is, true scientific method requires you to hold all other variables constant and then study only one variable that changes. And, that's almost impossible. It's a dynamic system. You pointed out in Arizona, the significant changes that were being made, but, of course, there were many other changes that were occurring in Arizona over that period of time that would affect races and, in fact, individual candidates affect races. Their qualities, etc. So the ability. So I am really skeptical of the real usefulness of these allegedly scientific studies because they aren't scientific, and they are driven often by policy outcomes and people just searching, finding friendly faces in the audience and talking about those.
And I think this is a problem that's reoccurring when you come into any sort of, especially litigation involving the electoral system, because you can find experts on either side who can come forward and debate on whether or not this has the intended effect, and they can pull out their studies which show conflicting results, and it's then left to the judge or the Supreme Court to sit down and adjudicate these things. And it comes down, unfortunately, I've seen this in the courtroom as well, where the partisan leanings of the judge seems to play quite a bit into the outcome of what sorts of reports that they're going to accept versus the other experts' reports. And so you have a politicized process, which probably doesn't help confidence in the system among the voters either. What I think is what should be done here, and I think David and I are in agreement that there's a lot of things that are being said that are thrown out there into the public sphere saying that these laws are going to have all these great effects. I think you need to keep it really simple. And if you keep it simple, then you might be able to tease out some real effects. Like, do you actually get parity in fundraising? I don't think we really know the answer to that question yet. So I think you need to look there at these very simple questions first and not try and make these more grand arguments about competitive elections or things like that, because in the end, it's going to be very difficult to untangle those.
One of the things that Jeff and I try to do in our studies, obviously, being a social scientist, I disagree slightly there's no value to this sort of scientific enterprise in terms of understanding campaign finance laws. If you imagine that you start with campaign finance laws at the top, so a law is enacted, and it can have any number of effects throughout this complex process. And instead of saying, what effect does it have on point A in the process, just look at the end point, so in this case, election outcomes, and say, does this campaign finance law change election outcomes? Now, you can answer that question pretty well with standard regression and statistical techniques. You can't. It's much harder to answer the question of via which of these routes in this complex web do the laws change outcomes. So it's very hard for us to get answers to how any one piece of the web looks like, if you will. But you can get from point A to the terminal point and answer the question of how on net do these laws change outcomes?
But David, assuming that everything else is going to be held constant in the system, and it's not. That's the whole problem with these sorts of studies, that there's so much dynamics that are going on there. The candidates are different, and the national mood is different. And so to piece it all together, we're going to need really, we're going to have to average over a large number of elections, and we're going to need to look at this 20 years from now. By then, the train's already going to be left the station before we have any definitive word one way or another about the efficacy of these laws.
Steve?
Oh, Professor Primo, you mentioned the reform and anti-reform groups, and you also talked about future debate, cost-benefit analysis. In your opinion, are you optimistic about reform and anti-reform agreeing what should go in the cost basket? And for Professor McDonald, you mentioned something about pothole races versus ideological races. You said that pothole races are more competitive now. And you seem to suggest, and I would just like you to clarify it any way you can, that a pothole race would be less susceptible to the alleged goals of public financing, whereas an ideological race may be somehow more susceptible to the goals of public financing. If you could clarify that for me. Thank you.
It's a good question about the issue of what's a cost and what's a benefit. And just the way I started off the discussion about arguments about whether or not this is taxpayer financed, whether voluntary checkoffs amount to taxpayer financing or not, is that a cost? Some might argue that, in fact, that's not a cost to the system, that's money that would have been used for something else, but it's not necessarily anything additional, any additional revenue being raised for it. So I do think there would be some disputes over what a cost is. I think this is true anytime you do cost-benefit analysis, anytime you do any sort of risk analysis. I mean, if you do analysis of whether a regulation for airline safety is worthwhile, something I've looked at a little bit, people will disagree about how you value a human life. Right? What is the cost, if you will, of a human life? And what's the value of a human life? And all of these discussions will take place with campaign finance. I have to be honest, though, while I'm calling for this cost-benefit analysis, and Jeff and I are pushing for this cost-benefit analysis, as I said, we're not naive in thinking that this will all of a sudden lead tomorrow to both sides of the debate coming forward and funding a multi-million dollar study that they both get to vet. Though if anybody's interested in doing that, we'd certainly be interested in hearing about it. But
your question's a good one. I'm having to sit here and think about it. What I meant about the gubernatorial elections is they're fundamentally different, was really my point, versus the legislative and Senate races and other races that we have out there. And so would you find in a non-ideological race elsewhere, beyond gubernatorial elections, would you find that money would perhaps have a larger effect than it would in an ideological contest? And perhaps yes. I mean, then you're getting out information about the quality of the candidates, and it's not people aren't going to base their vote merely on the D or R that's next to the name of the person there. So perhaps there you do need more information, but that is clearly just a gut response to your question. I think it's a good one, but I don't have anything firm to back it up with.
I wanted to ask about a paradox in public opinion that David touched on a little bit, but. And the paradox is that for some time, in polling in particular, if you ask people about campaign finance reform or similar questions in general, you get pretty strong majority support in favor. And for some period, if you ask them about various versions of support for public financing, you get about equal opposition. It's true that in the 1970s you have more support, and it tends to go downhill, such as the polling we have over the 80s and 90s down to this day. And that's supplemented by the fact that if you look at the checkoff systems at the national level or in a couple of states that have them, I'm thinking of Minnesota, there's a remarkable tight downward line in the number of people that participate. For example, the federal presidential system starts out with about 28% participation in the late 1970s. And today, it's in the area, the last numbers I saw were 11.4 in 2004. And if you chart it, it's just a straight downward line. My question is, what explains the paradox, and or more generally, why is both practically and in terms of poll responses, do you think public financing is relatively unpopular and in decline?
Do you want to? Well, I think one reason why we've seen a decline is that there's this disconnect between asking people in the abstract, do you support this reform, and then forcing them to actually do something, check off a box. And could also be that the climate of the times. If you think about the presidential race and you think about the most recent race and you say, well, I don't want my money to go to anybody like Kerry or like Bush, and you might just withhold because you don't like the candidates in the most recent presidential election or in the upcoming presidential election. It could also be that people misunderstand the questions, too. I mean, it could be the case that more people would check off the box if they really knew what the box was saying. I mean, I was just looking at the Arizona tax forms last week because I wanted to see how the law worked. They set it up better than the federal level. If you check off the box to give $5 to the campaign fund, you get $5 off your taxes. So that's actually $10 it's costing the state for $5 of funding because $5 goes back to you. So you, putting aside any normative concerns about public financing, you have every incentive in the world to check off that box. And even there, they're not getting huge participation rates. So there could be some sector of the public that's just opposed, others who don't understand it because the Arizona law, is the tax return is written in the most confusing way. So I think those factors come into play.
And perhaps if they were given $1 million, if they checked the box, more people would participate.
That would be an interesting experiment. Yeah. We could run that.
Do we have other questions from the audience? If not, I'll take my moderator's privilege. Given my sort of more narrow legal concerns, I'm going to ask about corruption and the appearance of corruption. Professor Prima, you stated earlier that there's no evidence of corruption. The studies don't show that votes follow money. But I'm curious as to how they determine that, because at least in terms of the studies I've seen, they suggest that money follows votes, but then you have the chicken and egg problem that Professor McDonald suggested. And then also for either of you or for Professor McDonald, you had sort of mentioned that, well, maybe communities that are more concerned with corruption, who perceive more corruption, are more likely to enact reform. And I would expand that question to ask, is there some phenomena where the reformist promoters going into a community beating the drum of reform in fact create the perception of reform, of corruption, therefore the need for reform, and whether or not you just sort of have this observer effect? Is that, of course, in those communities where they've enacted reform, they're going to think there's more corruption because that, they've been told that over and over again?
The way you get at this problem, because it certainly is a chicken and egg problem, that, you know, if I represent if I'm in a big union district and I get lots of contributions from people who are affiliated with unions, and then I vote pro-union, okay, did the people give me money so that I change my position and vote pro-union, or did I already hold that position? And trying to untangle those effects is certainly difficult. And what people have tried to do is essentially estimate both what affects what money you get and what affects your votes, and try to find variables that don't affect both. And in trying to do that, tease out the effects, and they're not finding much in the way of an impact. But I will say that if you don't believe any of the other studies I've talked about, you're certainly not going to believe that these are accurate, because these require a lot of assumptions in the methodology. So,
well, give me an example of something that would affect one but not the other, so that I could at least sort of see what they think they're trying to prove or what they think they've proven, rather than, I mean, you're right, I'm skeptical of all of it, but yeah, you said they want to tease out those factors that are independent. Which ones?
You could imagine that something like vote share in the previous election, so it might be an indicator of candidate quality, and that's something that might independently impact how many votes you get, but might not impact your views on an issue, let's say.
Why wouldn't it equally be impacted by your views on an issue? You get a lot of votes because people like your views.
But not your not in terms of whether you vote for or against any given piece of legislation. That's the argument. Now, in fairness, those studies have been criticized because trying to actually determine that that doesn't influence both variables is very difficult to do. So there is this great search in the economics literature for a variable that actually would solve this problem. And that's how Levitt has become famous and is probably going to win the Nobel Prize, is he's good at finding these sort of instruments. And so, but it's not an easy enterprise, certainly.
And President McDonald, the drumbeat of the reformist community influencing the perception?
Yes, I think is my answer to your question. I mean, you've pretty much summed it up. That, we don't know. We really don't know if before we'd have. I guess you'd have to look over time, but then you have to measure somehow the activity of these reformers in these areas. I imagine that there is a component of it where you come in and complain about the system, that people start paying attention to the complaints, and then they perceive that there's a problem in the system. And they've been very effective in Arizona. I mean, they've had three major election reforms in that state in the late 1990s. And I think it has something to do with Senator McCain being highly visible within the state supporting these things.
Other questions? Well, very good. Thank you. Thank you both, gentlemen. Also, I'd just like to thank the Federal Society for setting this up and arranging this, and all the folks who worked on this. Thank you very much, and thanks again.